Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Fiction. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered.
Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren. This is
102.3 FM Riverside
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren with a cold and all, and Mr. John Copenhaver. Hafer is back.
Hey, Al.
You know, I was going to say, you're back from the coronation. How was that?
It was gilded and stuffy. I don't know. I feel like there's nothing like watching it on TV to make you realize how you just, I don't understand it, but in an essential kind of way. I just don't. And so, like, but you know, it's kind of fun to be this outsider. You're like, oh, this makes, I'm such an American. Like, I really just don't understand this, you know? But people are very passionate about it, and which is cool too. It's just so interesting. I just don't get it, though. And I guess, you know, some of the other royals don't get it either, but.
Hey, listen, but I thought you were invited. I thought you were supposed to show up. You were one of the guys carrying the king's train.
Oh, no. I did not get invited. Oh. I'm not that special, Al.
You know, I can't figure out, you know, everyone's, I was waiting for Kid Rock to start shooting up the British beer.
Oh, jeez.
He had a longer train than most wedding brides, and he had more makeup than most brides, so I thought for sure they'd be shooting that up or something.
Gotta
be upset about something. Anyway, now speaking of makeup and long trains, we've got an author today. And let's talk to them. You've got a new book coming out, and it's James D.F. Hanna. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How y'all doing today?
I love that accent. That almost made my nipples hard.
Oh, dear.
This is interesting. You're right down my alley here with your books, your writing, and stuff like that. I find it very, very curious. You're writing a Malone series here, and so it's basically a Seamus series. Kind of, it's like a detective. If I'm right.
Yeah, it's a PI series set in southern West Virginia. Henry's a former West Virginia state trooper who was shot in the line of duty and is a recovering alcoholic. It's just kind of a personal mess. And is basically, the books are PI novels set in Appalachia, where I grew up. Because the Night is number 6.
How do you decide when you're doing a series like that? How do you put that together in your mind? Are you do you kind of know ahead of time how many books and how many things you want your characters to go through, or how far you develop them? Is this all kind of pre-planned?
No. So when I started writing the books in 2015 or so, it was really just kind of the effort to you know, finally finish a whole book. And then just as time progressed, I didn't have a story arc per se. I wasn't like, let's, you know, lead this to this to this to this or anything like that. But somewhere around the fourth book, I kind of started seeing, okay, I think I wanted to change some stuff with Henry. I really like to put him through the ringer. I like to make him suffer as much as possible. And so with the fifth book, Behind the Wall of Sleep, that was where I figured out he was going to possibly run for sheriff. He lives in Parker County, West Virginia. And so decided, okay, so he's going to run for sheriff. He's being funded, his campaign's being funded by the guy who owns the local strip club, a guy named Bada Bingham. And so then book 6 really became sort of like him dealing with the actual campaign And also kind of bringing together sort of a resolution to those three books, 4, 5, and 6, and setting up whatever I decide to do with the rest of books, with the rest of the series, however long that goes.
Well, so why is it you want to make him suffer? Like, who is he? Is he, is this like someone you know in real life?
So I am told by people who claim to be my friend that they read the books and they're like, wow, you, Henry sounds a lot like you, and he's kind of a jerk. And I'm like, gosh, thanks. We're not getting a book dedicated to you now. So I was very much a reader of PI fiction growing up. And I read in that second wave of PI novels that came with the with Spencer, with Robert B. Parker. And, you know, the guys like Parker, Pronzini, Lawrence Block, obviously, female writers like Marcia Muller, Sue Grafton, Sarah Paretsky, the folks who were really kind of changing that voice. And they, you know, where the PI got to be, he got to have a deeper well of emotion. He got, or she, you know, they had complicated lives. They weren't only about the case the way that old school privatized were, you know, in the Chandler Hammett mode. But conversely, I never wanted Henry to be the smartest guy in the room. I wanted to try and flip that paradigm of where, like, the PI is always the toughest guy or the smartest guy. Henry is not the toughest guy. He is not the smartest guy. He is never the smartest guy in the room. What he is the guy who doesn't know when to stop. And even when he does try to, there's that part of him that won't let himself stop. And so with that comes, you know, him just being pushed further and harder into increasingly dangerous circumstances and situations. And out of that, I hope there comes growth for him. Because in the first book, he is very much a jerk. Because he's struggling with his drinking. He's struggles with, you know, he doesn't have the identity of being a state trooper anymore. His wife has left him. He's very much a wreck. And so by, you know, book 6, his life is steadier and he's trying to define himself in a different way, possibly by becoming sheriff, but it's not going to be that easy for him, obviously.
How do you come up with the dialogue in a story like this? Like, I'd imagine you don't live like the main character. You're not in the same world as he is. So how is it you create that dialogue?
I shamelessly rip off conversations I have with
friends. Oh, good.
Seriously, one of my best friends read Behind the Wall of Sleep, read book 5, and they were like, how many of these conversations did you just take verbatim that we have had? I was like, at least 4. But no, which is not even a joke. But as far as dialogue goes, honestly, I kind of go with that Aaron Sorkin rule. I like to hear smart people say smart things, or things which are funny, at least. I'm really about rhythm in dialogue. I like the rat-a-tat-tat. Very much of that Elmore Leonard school, you know, where you'll drop in and you'll read a Leonard novel just for the dialogue sometimes. And that's a thing I really strive for, is because I want that very specific rhythm between characters.
How do you experience that? Are you actually hearing your characters and their dialogue in your head or not? Like, are you that type of writer?
I am completely. I always say that it's basically all just transcribing the voices in my head. And it is. It is very much. I don't always know what the characters are going to say. I mean, like, literally there are points where I'm surprised by the stuff that comes out of, you know, their mouths, I guess is the right word. I'm surprised sometimes by what shows up on the page, which is always great. I mean, anytime you're surprising yourself, and you're the creator of this particular world, and you're surprising yourself, hopefully that then is entertaining for the reader.
You don't get into trouble when you're driving and you hear all these voices, like, you're not...
No, I'm not standing out or anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to see if they let you drive or not.
It is. And so I have my phone, my notes app is just littered with chunks of dialogue, with descriptions, with little narrative ideas and threads that just pop up, like when I'm out for a run, or just driving, you know, like you said, like driving somewhere. These ideas, you know, it just comes out of nowhere and shows up. And then it's, you know, basically, you know, because I'm a safe driver, I have to pull off to the side of the road and write stuff down on my phone. Because I don't want to lose that.
It's amazing. You know, I'm always in awe of writers that can do that. And it's like such a good habit to get in the, you know, write, keeping whatever, however you do it, whether you do it on your phone or carry a little notebook around with you. I think it's like such a good idea. I am terrible at that. I just pretend I can remember things until I can sit down at my desk and jot them down. It's a terrible plan, so I'm always in awe of that. So I have a question. I actually grew up in southwestern Virginia.
Okay.
And so I love the, of course, I'm just fascinated by, you know, writing crime fiction in rural spaces. And, you know, you said you grew up in southwestern West Virginia, is that right?
Yeah, southern West Virginia / eastern Kentucky.
Yeah, so that we're not probably as a crow flies, we probably didn't grow up that far apart. But like, how can you talk a little bit about how that sort of influenced your writing and maybe also like your, you know, writing crime books as well?
So that was really interesting because I'm 3 generation, you know, like the past 3 generations of my family were all like coal miners, railroad workers, tobacco farmers. I always have had a rural sensibility. I mean, I grew up in a holler in eastern Kentucky called Turkey Creek, and it is a holler. It's not a hollow.
Right.
And I always define a holler as that space between two mountains that God forgets about. But so growing up, though, like I said, you know, I read a lot of crime fiction. I read Block. I read Ed McBain, Parker, Rex Stout. I read all of these very urban crime writers, all of these, you know, everything set in big cities, set in L.A., set in Boston, set in Philadelphia. And so when I tried to write, I didn't have a correlatory experience for any of that. You know, I'd never... You know, I never saw an escalator until my teen years. You know, I grew up really small, super small town. I grew up in one of those eastern Kentucky towns where if the football team is traveling on Friday night, there's no one in town. You know, last one out, turn off the lights. But I didn't, at that time, I didn't see any novels that felt like, you know, they reflected that. Everything felt... You know, you read Donald Westlake, or, you know, in his Richard Stark novels, and occasionally, you know, Parker would be in a small town somewhere in a heist, but otherwise that was it. When I sat down, and so I spent years, though, trying to write a big city novel, and I couldn't do it, because I never lived in a big city. And then when I finally started a version of what eventually became Midnight Lullaby, which was the first Henry Malone novel, I realized, you know what, I'm just going to write this book in a milieu that I understand. I'm going to write it in a, you know, set it in a small town. I'm going to set it in one of these, you know, 2 stoplight towns in West Virginia that I understand. And, you know, that just, everything grew from that. Everything grew from the acceptance that I could write something about the small town. I could write about those people, which I understood more than trying to write about banking or stockbrokers or anything that felt metropolitan. But I could write about, you know, those, you know, the lonely stretches, you know, between towns, you know, where you're driving through the hills and the roads are barely wider than the width of your car. And, you know, towns where basically everything shuts up, you know, shuts off at, you know, 7 o'clock at night. And I got that. I understood that. And so I managed to do that for six of these, you know, 6 Malone books and then a standalone that takes place in Parker County. I haven't lived in West Virginia in a few years now. That's still what I'm familiar with. That is the environment I'm most familiar with. I mean, so I'm still most comfortable writing about.
Is there something you wanted people to get out of this book, and even the series? Like, when you do a book in a series and you finish it, is there some sort of subtext or meaning to the book?
I always say that I don't have my aspirations are strictly storytelling. I want the story to be entertaining. I want the characters to feel true. I want them to be entertaining and realistic. Even if they are exaggerated, I want them to feel real. I want people to not judge Appalachia, I think, the way that it has been judged in a lot of ways. We don't need a reckoning so much as an adjustment, probably. And I would like for people to understand there's a lot more to that area, to what I term cultural Appalachia, than they know or understand. I hope they get that. But more than anything, I want the book to be entertaining.
What is a good book to you? What keeps you reading?
So I am very much I'm very much into a lot of Southern writing right now, a lot of the new Southern lore, I guess. You have someone like S.A. Cosby, who, you know, has kind of proven to people that you can write about rural America and really just write a hard-edged crime novel that way. Guys like Eli Craner, Bobby Matthews, Mark Westmoreland, these guys who are writing, Kelly J. Ford, Amina Akhtar, Laura McHugh. I'm really drawn to the writers who are telling these Southern, these rural stories, and are telling them in a way that is respectful, that is different, that emphasizes a diversity, that doesn't just lean on the same, you know, white guy tropes that have been, you know, kind of bandied about within the genre for years. And they're all telling interesting stories within those areas that are very much about character. You know, first and foremost, they're writing about these really deep, interesting characters who are relatable, regardless of, I think, if you're, you know, from a city or from the country, you can read them and be drawn in. So I'm always about character and voice in whoever I'm reading. I want to read the strongest, most distinct voice with the strongest character.
You mentioned that there are things that folks are getting wrong about Appalachia. And I think it's really interesting because there's lots of things to talk about. I'm fascinated about this conversation, you know, because I grew up there. And I strongly agree. I think that the world does get Appalachia wrong. I'm curious in what ways you think that's true. And I'm also curious generally about just rural fiction. Because I think there's like the specific things you get wrong about Appalachia, but there's also kind of things about general sort of assumptions about rural life that I think we get wrong. Anyway, what do you think? What are we getting wrong about Appalachia sometimes from the outside?
I think there's a lot of presumption with Appalachia that, you know, like I'm right now, I'm reading a book called What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, weirdly enough. Kate. And, you know, it's very much a response to Hillbilly Elegy, to J.D. Vance's book. And I think J.D. Vance gets, you know, J.D. Vance is a great example of someone who gets everything wrong about Appalachia. Because, one, I think there's this very whitewashed concept of what Appalachia is, but then it ignores that there's a lot more diversity to the area. I think there's this, you know, Scotch-Irish mythology I think people really have to the area. That's what I said when I say cultural Appalachia. It's really that stretch from Virginia into Kentucky that goes down through, like Georgia and places like that, where, as opposed to like geographic Appalachia, which is, you know, 2,000 miles or something like that. I think, you know, there's this idea that, you know, the tropes which have existed about Appalachia for decades and decades and decades now, dating back to, you know, the Hatfield McCoys, the Hatfields and the McCoys, that, you know, everyone's basically, you know, that people are still holding a grudge about that even is a thing that amuses the hell out of me. People think we're still fighting that. We're not. You know, people think, you know, there's a paradigm that people are not interested in bettering themselves, that they're, you know, that they're lazy. And the truth is Appalachia is really just an area that has been maligned for so long and been created into the butt of jokes for so long that is as much the reason of why they don't trust, of why Appalachians don't trust people. Why they, you know, the scorn of the outsider is one of the great Appalachian tropes, which is not necessarily wrong, but it's also a self-defense mechanism, because more than anything, what I think Appalachians want is a chance, you know. And, you know, we're not just, you know, all marrying cousins and drinking moonshine. There's a lot of great stuff that comes out of that area, and it just needs an opportunity to shine a little bit.
Yeah, Deliverance was a good movie.
Deliverance. Georgia, I would like to point this out.
It's true. You sure got a pretty mouth. Oh, anyway, yeah.
talk about a movie that did do that, though. Like, that certainly, and a book, of course, did a lot to sort of create a lot of the negative stereotypes that still haunt that area.
Oh,
and, I mean, not intentionally, I think.
How do you counter that when it's been done? Even the tropes that gay people get, and even the all of the stuff. So it's been done for so many years. So how is it that you can wake people up, so to speak?
That's where I think you really do have, you know, you have folks like Ford. You have these writers who are telling new stories, and they're telling different stories, and they're telling them from the viewpoints that people are not expecting. You know, Sean has always told, you know, Sean's told me the story before that, you know, people didn't want him to write his first, you know, people didn't want him writing about black experience in Virginia. In rural Virginia. No, they wanted like a big city crime novel. And he was like, that's not who I am. He's telling his story, and he's telling a story that I think is very overlooked, is very often overlooked. I think then, you know, when you have also then conversely, you have someone like Kelly, who I think is wonderful. And I think Copperheads is one of the best, you know, Southern noir novels in the last probably 10 years. And she's talking about being a lesbian in the South, and is very, with this really strong individualistic voice. I think it just, it becomes the accumulation of those voices. And I say this as a straight, cisgendered white guy who acknowledges, you know, this is the story I'm telling. But what I really want is I do want this other diversity of stories, because for me, more diversity means better stories. Plurality, you know, a greater diversity of voices is vital for good story, and not just good storytelling, but also for overall truth, you know, so that we are creating those new, black bear term, tropes, where, you know, we can, you know, it's not going to happen overnight, obviously, because where we got now didn't happen overnight. But it is that slow, you know, Sherman's march, you know, through Atlanta, essentially, of working to get rid of those old voices and replace them and show something that feels more honest and reflective of now.
I can't help but think that each time you write a book like this in this series, that it means a lot to you, even though you present it as entertainment and there's the underlying theme. But how do you think that each book in this series, as you complete it, changes you as a writer?
So I think every book is, it's very much its own distinct experience. So I wrote Behind the Wall of Sleep very quickly. The fifth book, the one that won the Seamus. I think I wrote it in like 3 months. When it came down to the time that I was trying to write Because the Night, that took 9 months. And that is 9 months after 2 years and probably trashing about 250,000 words to be able to finally get to this book. And so this book really changed me in a way that it made me more determined. It really made me want to keep pushing as a storyteller. Someone who's very, I consider myself very fortunate and privileged to get to do this. And this book, because it was so hard, because it was such a struggle, really just made me appreciate the ability to get to tell a story, to get to tell these stories, and to also kind of want to look at, you know, what are some of the other stories I want to tell? What are some of the other journeys I think maybe I can put on a page? You know, probably, you know, and explore with some different characters and see where that goes.
So I can't help but also think that the setting must be very important, being as you're talking about the location and how people are much more than what the country or even the world sees them as. How important is the setting to you? Are you writing it as if it's a character itself?
Very much so. I haven't lived in West Virginia for a while, but I'm constantly, so I still have a lot of friends who keep me up to date with everything, and I am the person who is on Google Maps all the time because I want everything to feel realistic. I want the terrain to feel true. I want, you know, if someone from back home is reading this book and they're like, that's not how that would be, I'm going to hear about it. So I want the geography to feel true. I want it to feel culturally true. So you do a lot of research about, say, like, you know, the Italian population in Clarksburg, West Virginia, which was huge. And that, you know, feeds into everything else. I'm never a big fan when people say that, the area becomes a character, the city becomes a character. But honestly, that's very true. You know, your storytelling is typically always reflective by where you're setting the story, by where you're setting the stage. And so getting all of that right, though, is really important to me. Because like you said, hundreds, you know, at least 100 years of other people coming in and telling the Appalachian story, and now the opportunity to kind of get to tell an Appalachian story myself. That's important to get it right.
Well, you know, sort of, maybe this is sort of part two of the same question, but, you know, I do think, and I wonder if you would agree that it's setting is in part like its impact on character. So my question is, how do you go about building characters? What do you do to create a compelling character?
So I am a deeply instinctual writer. Honestly, as I'm starting to write, I have ideas. You know, basically I'm working off of fragments of ideas. I kind of know, I have ideas about who the character is. Like with Henry, I didn't know a whole lot about him when I started writing about him. And so as I've written the books, it really is just, it's discovery. And again, it's like I said earlier, sometimes I'm surprised by the things that my characters say. Very often I am surprised by, you know, where they end up traveling. The Henry's girlfriend shows up in the second book, and I had no intention of her becoming his girlfriend until someone read the second book and they were like, so are they together in the third book? And I was like, well, I guess they are now. Because everything, again, it just goes back to a discovery process. That is, I'm not someone who does the really intricate outline or anything like that. I don't do character sketches. I am just going to the page and writing and writing and writing, and then eventually it starts to flow and it fits and it feels right, and the characters come into play, and I understand them more as it progressed.
Since it's detective fiction, though, you must... Is it difficult to sort of work out a plot? Because, I mean, I guess you're sort of more of a, quote-unquote, pantser, as you sort of more exploratory writer. Do you ever have to rewrite a lot, or do you ever find yourself having to outline and do that kind of thing? It's... I'm always fighting the two, like the instinctual writing with the more structured writing, so I'm curious what your process is.
Yeah, no, my process is a nightmare, John. It's just a complete and utter nightmare. Because I do, I have pantsed my way through each one of these books, each one of the Malone books, and I rewrite extensively. I rewrite everything to within an inch. I have any short story I've written, any novel I've written, everything is rewritten. That whole concept of like the three drafts and you're done, I don't understand that, because I will go through 5, 6, 7 drafts. And again, you know, it's rewriting for plot a lot of times. It is, oh, I didn't know this person was the killer until now, but... I didn't know this was how this was going to turn out. I'm always surprised, but, I rewrite so much. I rewrite just insane amounts and cut whole swaths. So I'll tell you this, this is how much of a rewriter I am. I wrote an original draft of this book. That was about 92,000 words. And then as I was rewriting it, I realized it was not good, like, at all. And so I shaved off, I took the first 8 or 10,000 words of it and wrote a completely different book. Had absolutely no bearing whatsoever to what I wrote originally. And most people would be like, that is insane, and they would be correct. Because it is a chaotic process to kind of go through. Now, I have a book that I just finished that is first draft. I'm getting ready to go back into revisions on it, and I did outline that. And now I'm realizing probably as I go into writing a second draft, a lot of it is going to be like, shaving out, like, there's too much plot, you know, and, you know, it's like shaving out some of the plot, putting in some more character beats, kind of expanding some relationships. It is every book is a little different. Every book is a little different, I guess. I have not figured out, though, the really, like, okay, I have a plot, and I'm plotted out, and I'm going to write it, and then just be, you know, then you go back in the second draft, and you're just fine-tuning things. I don't know how that works. God love the folks who do.
How do you know when it's done? It's over. It's finished. Is there something that happens? One of those voices calls you and said, hey, you're done.
I always say I know I'm done when I'm sick and tired of it. When I realize that any more editing, any more writing, any more whatever is just diminishing returns. There's nothing else I can do to it that is going to necessarily make it better. It is just, at this point, it's the creature that it is. And that's when I'm just sort of like, okay, I'm going to send this to an editor and let them deal with it now.
So your editors love you.
Oh, yeah, no, deeply. This was an interesting experience for me because I self-published the first the Malone books originally. And I was self-published when Behind the Wall of Sleep won the Seamus. And then Down and Out Books, when they picked the book, you know, the books back up and republished them. And so this was like my first real sort of, you know, working with my publisher experience. And, whereas I kind of was, you know, elbow deep in everything, doing everything myself. This was the first time that, you know, I'm, you know, coordinating everything with a publisher and working working with the editors and things like that. It's been a really interesting experience. It's been a good experience. And I'm happy to be having to have the book ready to come out.
Well, give us the names of the people that you don't like in the company. We have someone on the line.
Right.
And they have something to say. No. Well, so do you like working with a publisher better than self-published, or what's your feeling on both?
So I do like it. It is a very different, it's a different experience, because when you self-publish again, you know, you're doing everything. So when I self-published, I did hire a proofreader, but I was like formatting books myself. I have a graphic design background, so I was designing covers. Any promotion, anything was all on me. It is nice to work with a publisher and have the book done, and then just give it to them, and they work with it. They send me back some proofs. I do that, go back, you know, we figure out the cover. Self-publishing is great if you really have control issues, because you control it. Working with a publisher, you know, and down and out, they're a fairly nimble group. We can, with self-publishing, you might finish a book on a Monday, and then you put that book out the next Monday. There's actually, there was actually like 6 or 8 months between, I sent them the book and now it's coming out. Kind of working with that, not having all of that control and sense of autonomy has been different. But it's also been nice to, like I said, to give them the book, and then I can go and start working on something else. I'm not just sitting and sweating about the book and what's happening to it.
You ever go back to your earlier stuff and want to rewrite it?
So much so. And in fact, actually, so when Down and Out picked the books up, I did a gentle rewrite over a couple of them. I would really love someday to probably rework some stuff, because, I mean, you know, those were the learning books, so to speak. You know, you're figuring out how to, you know, you're building the car while you're driving, someone told me. And I think that's fairly true. You're learning the whole process as you're doing it. It's kind of like your own MFA program, so to speak. And though ultimately your professors are the reviews on Goodreads.
Scary thought.
Oh, terrifying.
So the bad characters, the evil people, the ones that do something wrong in the book, are you able to capture that person or people easily from all of your bad history yourself, or where does it come from?
So I think a lot of that is just sort of, it's unmitigated id. It's taking all of those dark impulses that you have, you know, but also, you know, there's, you know, certain levels of truism, you know. You have to be able to write, I think, anytime you have an antagonist, I think someone told me once that your antagonist is the protagonist in his or her own mind, of their own story. They're the good guy. And so really with any of the bad guys, I really try and approach it that way. You know, they think they're doing, you know, whatever they're doing it for the right reasons in their mind. Which then makes whatever terrible thing they're doing in their minds justifiable, and probably therefore worse than if they were just like curling a mustache and tying someone to, you know, train tracks.
Dating yourself there.
Oh, yeah.
Snidely or with my... Well... So how do people find you? Where do you hang out? You're on street bars, corners, like what? Do you have a website, social media, hookup apps?
I have a table and a bar.
Yeah.
I have a table at a bar here in Louisville. So you can find me. I am on Twitter way more than I should, at least until Musk burns the joint down. You can find me there at James D.F. Hanna. And also at my I'm on, you can find me Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at James D.F. Hanna, and you can find me at my website, www.jamesdfhanna.com, because I wanted to keep it simple. And there's a link to on my website, there's a link to my Substack, where I occasionally will write about whatever crosses my mind. It's called That Noise at 2 a.m.
Yeah, someone told me you had a big Substack. So what does the DF stand?
Donald Francis.
I wasn't expecting that. But that's all, you know, it's all good. So what's next? So what's happening now? You've got this out, and your mind must be wandering into some other new ventures.
So I've got this one out. I've got this Calls the Night is out. June 19th, I have a novella out in a series that Frank Zaffiro edits. A Grifter's Song, that's out now. My installment's called Somewhere Outside Salvation, and it takes place back in West Virginia. And it's about two con artists on the run who find themselves pulling a con involving a traveling carnival. There's some Mothman mythos involved in that. I wrote that for Frank and had a lot of fun with that. That was me playing with some carnival noir. And so right now, like, you know, I'm working on edits on a new book that's takes place in 1976, small town in Kentucky. Two brothers, moonshine, bikers, kind of seeing where it goes with that. Like I said, I've got the first draft done, and we're working on.
Wow, are you doing any book shows or script jobs or anything like that?
You know, we'll probably be at some festivals this year. I'll be at Sleuth Fest down in Boca in July, and I'll be at BoucherCon end of August.
Making the rounds. So, well, now it's time to go. We appreciate you being here. We'll have all of your information up on our website as well. And we're talking about Because the Night. It's a Henry Malone novel. And the writer of that was our guest, Mr. James D.F. Hanna. Thank you for being here.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, James.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This is the introduction of the Wave Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.